Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. You have to look no further than world oil prices to understand the profound effect Saudi Arabia has on the world economy. Today, we'll look at how the kingdom is newly asserting its view in the political arena in its region and why exactly they have opened the oil spigots to the world and depressed world oil markets. Plus, we'll also look back to the time when the U.S.-Saudi relationship was most strained. In the days after 9/11, when it was revealed that 15 of the 19 men who carried out the September 11th attacks were Saudi citizens. Well, my guest today was the U.S. ambassador during that period, as Robert Jordan served in the post from 2001 to 2003. Jordan is currently a diplomat in residence and adjunct professor of political science at Southern Methodist University. He was a partner at the international law firm Baker Botts for many years and later headed the firm's Middle East practice based in Dubai. He's a member of the Board of Governors of the Middle East Institute and serves on the advisory board of the bilateral U.S.-Arab Chamber of Commerce. He's written a memoir of his time, Desert Diplomat, Inside Saudi Arabia Following 9/11. It's published by Potomac Books. And he was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week. Ambassador Jordan, welcome to Studio Tulsa, and welcome back to Tulsa. You're a native Tulsan.
Great to be here again.
Before we talk about what's going on with Saudi Arabia today, we should pick up the story, as you do in your book, Desert Diplomat, about how you became ambassador to Saudi Arabia. You're not in the Foreign Service. How did you become ambassador to Saudi Arabia?
Well, I've actually asked myself that question a few times as well. But I was a lawyer in Dallas for many years. It turns out that the Saudis will not give diplomatic credentials to a U.S. ambassador who is a career Foreign Service officer. They want someone who is a close personal friend of the president, who can get the White House on the phone and have his calls returned, who can go over the heads of the bureaucracy, and frankly, who doesn't have a career to protect. And so those were my credentials. I had never been to the Middle East, didn't speak Arabic.
You had represented President George W. Yep. Bush in a matter before the SEC, correct?
There was an investigation with the SEC in the early 90s, and it ended up really well for the president. He thought I was a genius, and I let him think that. And so we became good friends. He then became governor of Texas. We would spend the night with the Bushes in the governor's mansion a few times. And I would advise him on judicial appointments and things of that nature. So when he was elected president, we talked a little bit about what I might do in his administration. In fact, I have to tell you, I called him to congratulate him after the election or after the Supreme Court decision. I got his voicemail, so he then called me back. And he left me this voicemail, and he said, "Hey, Bob, this is George returning your call." Oh, I guess I should say President-elect Bush. And at that moment, things changed. He was no longer George. He was then President-elect Bush and later Mr. President.
Yeah.
And that never changes. But we talked a bit about what I might do in the Justice Department, other, a few other things. And finally, the White House called and said the president wanted me to be his ambassador to Saudi Arabia. And I thought that was about the worst idea I'd ever heard. But I agonized over it. I actually agonized for quite a while.
No, in your private practice, I think it's James Baker's law practice,
yes,
correct?
Yes, the Baker Botts law firm.
Yeah,
right.
So that law firm is famous for going all around the world. And so had you had ties to the Middle East before?
Never. I'd never been to the Middle East. I could locate it on a map, but that was about it. I had done some international litigation involving Mexico and a few other places like that.
But never the Middle East?
Never, no. My dad had lived in Libya for a while at one moment, but not for very long.
Right. So your first reaction on hearing they want to make you the ambassador to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is, thanks, but no thanks? Or
well, I was very hesitant. Yeah. My family was hesitant. I had the same stereotypical views, I think, that most of us do, which is this is a place that doesn't like Westerners. They treat women badly. Their human rights record is terrible. And we aren't sure if they're friend or foe. This was a time when terrorism was starting to become an issue in the Middle East, and we certainly knew about their religious extremism. It was a hot, dusty place. You couldn't get a drink there. And it was just not the kind of place I wanted to go. But, you also really can't say no under these circumstances. And I recall my son was home on spring break from Duke University. And he turned to me one night and he said, "You know, Dad, when your friend, the President of the United States, asks you to serve your country, you can't say no, can you?" And I said, "No, Peter, I can't. I recognize that." So I then talked with Andy Card, who was the chief of staff of the White House. And Andy said, can you do a year? I said, sure, I can do anything for a year. So that was our deal. And he said, anything on top of a year, we'll just consider that on the plus side. But if you can give us a year, we really need you out there.
So this is the spring of 2001.
This is April or so of 2001.
Yeah.
And so I then start trying to learn how to be an ambassador. Went to Washington about 3 days a week for consultations with think tanks and the State Department. We went through what was called the ambassadorial seminar, where about 10 ambassadors and spouses would go through learning how to run an embassy. One of the instructors had been the ambassador to Brazil, and his advice was, be sure that you take charge of your embassy, and on day one, be sure everyone knows that. Said on his first day at the embassy in Brazil, he walked in and pulled the fire alarm, and all hell broke loose. And he said two things were accomplished. First, he got to see how they responded to an emergency. And second, they knew he was in charge. He wasn't afraid to do anything, to pull any button, to push any button. He was the boss.
And we think that when the ambassador is a political appointee, and that's the same whether it's France, the UK, or places like Japan where it's a career politician, some of these special ambassadorships, we really think of the embassy being and the relations being run by the professional State Department. You're saying that's not necessarily the case?
No, the ambassador, whether it's a career ambassador or a political appointee, is in charge, and you have to let them know you're in charge. Around the world, we have probably 150 embassies overall, and about 100 of those are career Foreign Service ambassadors. And so the other 50 are political appointees. Some are in places like London and Paris. And even now, Caroline Kennedy is in Japan.
Right.
But you also have a number in other posts where they're perhaps less glamorous, but there's a lot of hard work to be done. Mine was one of those roll-up-your-sleeves kind of embassies.
Now, and of course, by the time you took office in Riyadh, you're looking at 9/11 had occurred.
Yes. I had not yet been confirmed by the Senate when 9/11 hit. I was actually waiting till about January was the plan, since the Democrats were controlling the Senate. Joe Biden was the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, and things were a little frosty with the White House, so their nominees were going slow. But as soon as 9/11 hit, Biden said, all right, we'll give you a quick confirmation hearing if you go straight to your post. Don't stay around for language training. Don't stay around for more consultations or Christmas or whatever. Just get out there. And so that was our deal, and that's exactly what happened.
And so you arrive in Riyadh. This is in the immediate days after 9/11. And the feeling from the Saudi government is those hijackers couldn't possibly be Saudis, correct?
It was really amazing to hear this from them. I made one of my first calls on the governor of Riyadh, Prince Salman, who is actually now the king.
Yeah.
And he said, this could not have been Saudis who were the hijackers. This had to have been an Israeli plot. The Mossad must have done this. And then I went on to the Minister of Interior, Prince Nayef, who's like the head of their FBI. And he said the same thing. This had to have been an Israeli plot. Finally, I got to the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Prince Saud al-Faisal. And Prince Saud had attended Princeton. He spoke better English than I did. And he really got it. He understood they had an extremism problem in their midst. They had to do something about it. And now was the time.
Why was there such a disconnect within the ruling circles of the kingdom at that particular point?
I think the Saudis had never really had to answer to the public for anything, and they didn't quite know what to say. I think they also were probably in a state of denial and disbelief. You know, I have three sons, and if someone told me one of my sons had done something like this, I'd probably be in denial. And I think it shows also perhaps how out of touch some of these elder ministers were. They simply couldn't believe that something like this could happen.
Was it a matter they're just autocrats and they just did not have to deal with ordinary people of their kingdom?
I think that's a certain element of it. They've never had to answer in that, quite that same sense.
When did the light finally begin to shine, light turn on? It was probably during your second year the third year.
A couple of things happened. I brought out a CIA briefer from Washington who gave them conclusive evidence that these hijackers were Saudis. That, I think, satisfied them at least to some degree, although even a year later, Prince Nayef, the interior minister, was quoted as saying this still was an Israeli plot. But we started working with the Saudis. Initially, it was very difficult. They would not share with us the results of interrogations. We would give them names of suspects to round up and bring in for interrogation. They wouldn't let us talk to them. They wouldn't share with us what we call the pocket litter, which was in their pockets and their computer hard drives. And so we had to start working a little more closely with them to get their trust and to get to know them a little better. At the same time, we had problems in our own government and our own officials out in the field. The CIA and FBI operatives didn't talk to each other. They didn't trust each other. I would occasionally be asked by the CIA, for example, to go to the Saudis and say, look, we gave you these lists of suspects to bring in. We haven't heard anything for months. What's going on here? And they would say to me, well, we gave that list to the FBI 2 months ago. Why don't you guys share with each other? So I would have to go to Washington, talk to George Tenet at the CIA, Bob Mueller at the FBI, and try to get them to play nice with each other. We also were under-resourced. I think even ever since the days of the Church Commission in the 1970s, our CIA has been handicapped, to some degree properly so. But they haven't had the resources. They only had a very few Arabic speakers. The FBI had even fewer. And so they were handicapped in many ways in trying to do their jobs. But there was a cultural issue between the two agencies that I think finally got better after we pounded the table a few times. But we had a lot of work to do within our own government as well.
Well, as you probably well know, you know, the official Washington sort of belief system is that, you know, the House of Bush and the House of Saud are incredibly tight. Are you saying that that's perhaps not as true as most people would think?
That's largely a load of baloney. there's actually, after I left office and came back, someone told me there was a movie out there called Fahrenheit 9/11 by a guy named Michael Moore, and I'm in it. And they go into this House of Bush, House of Saud thing, and they talk about the Carlyle Group and the bin Laden's investing money with Carlyle, that somehow Bush was on the board and a lot of connections. And then they show a picture of me, and they say that here's this guy, Jordan, who got Bush off from an SEC investigation, and he was rewarded by being made ambassador to Saudi Arabia. Well, it didn't feel much like a reward when I was doing it, even though it was honored to serve the president. But it's really a fiction that there was this somehow cozy relationship. Bush 41 certainly knew the Saudis well, and he was good social friends with Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador. But in terms of policy, it was still a very much a difficult relationship. And certainly after 9/11, the criticism that flowed from the United States toward the Saudis and all Muslims.
They heard that.
They heard it very much. And even in our own Defense Department, we would have figures like Franklin Graham criticizing Muslims and then being allowed to give speeches and invocations at the Pentagon. And so they viewed that as some sort of official condoning of anti-Muslim messages. And so then the resentment started to flow the other way, back from the Saudis against the United States.
Well, finally, in 2003, when we had the Western living quarters that were bombed, that really opened their eyes, correct?
I think that was a real turning point. We had three Western housing compounds bombed the night of May 12, 2003. And a number of Americans were killed. A number of Saudis were killed and wounded as well. In fact, the son of the deputy mayor of Riyadh was one of those killed. And Crown Prince Abdullah told me the next day that they would hunt down and capture or kill all those in charge of it, all those behind it. In addition, they would capture or kill and treat just as harshly anyone who condoned it or anyone who had given aid or comfort to these terrorists. So we then saw over the next couple of years a series of shootouts where the Interior Ministry and the police would actually infiltrate these al-Qaeda cells. They would go after these guys. And we saw a period of violence, but they were very much eradicated from Saudi Arabia by around 2006.
My guest today is Ambassador Robert W. Jordan, a former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia from 2001 to 2003. He recounts his story of being the ambassador during that critical time in U.S.-Saudi relations in his book, Desert Diplomat Inside of Saudi Arabia Following 9/11. He's currently a diplomat in residence and adjunct professor of political science at Southern Methodist University and former Tulsa. He grew up here in Tulsa. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. Well, let's talk about today. That governor of Riyadh that you spoke of is now King Salman. What do we need to know about him?
Well, first of all, I think he is considered one of the least corrupt of the senior potentates in the Middle East. He's very well respected. He spent almost 50 years as governor of Riyadh, and that meant that he was kind of the royal family sheriff. Any bad actors in the royal family were sent to him for punishment or rehabilitation or whatever. He knew all the family secrets. But more than that, he was also known as a really hard worker. Before becoming king, he was named Minister of Defense. And he's widely known for being such a hard worker, he's at his desk at 8 o'clock every morning. Well, he showed up at the Ministry of Defense the first day, and the only other person there was the gate guard to let him in. The next day, everyone was there at 8 o'clock. And he is a stern taskmaster. He is a very serious administrator, and I think someone who takes his job very seriously.
What about his relationship with the United States? Has it been a close one, or has he been more segregated from being the governor of Riyadh for so long? Has he been less involved with U.S. and Saudi affairs?
He has been focused largely on domestic affairs. But even as the governor of Riyadh, he would be involved in high-level cabinet meetings. He would be involved in high-level visitors who would be coming to see perhaps the king or the crown prince, and would also stop by and see him as well. But I don't think he was nearly as sophisticated about military or international affairs as his predecessor, Abdullah. Abdullah had been the head of the Saudi National Guard, which is the royal guard, basically, a large elite force for many years. And so I think he had a bit more exposure to the security issues surrounding the kingdom. And Salman was really more focused on domestic issues.
Hmm. Has there been anything surprising about his reign so far? And how much power does the king of Saudi Arabia have? Is it a presidium of where he is the first among equals, or is it autocratic, or is it a short number of high-level members of the family that all sort of consult and he makes the decisions?
It's not really autocratic in the sense that the king can snap his fingers and make something happen. They operate very much by consensus within the senior members of the royal family. So there are probably 15 or 20 senior royals whose consensus is sought on every major issue. The king certainly has the last word, but it would be rare for him to go against an overwhelming consensus to the contrary.
Or even a majority against his position?
They have a political sense about them. Uh-huh. They also have a political sense about trying to curry favor with their own population, even their non-royal population. And so the king reaches out to communities and is seen going into these communities and shaking hands and kissing babies in kind of the same way that we might see American politicians do it. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I think is unusual about King Salman is the extent to which he has seized power in a very aggressive way since King Abdullah passed away earlier this year. He has appointed one of his youngest sons as the deputy crown prince and also the minister of defense. This is a guy, Mohammed bin Salman, who is 29 years old, we believe, very little experience, but in a very powerful position, not only as minister of defense and deputy crown prince, but he also heads the economic council of the kingdom, which means he's in charge of the entire economy. So this has ruffled some feathers. People have taken note that he has jumped the queue with his
It's been a mixture of brothers and uncles and that have ruled the kingdom, and it sounds like he's sort of setting up his own line, if you will.
And that hasn't really happened before.
Yeah.
The tradition has been that the most qualified elder sons of the founder of the kingdom, King Abdulaziz, would succeed to the throne rather than through their sons. And so it's from one brother or half-brother to the other. Of course, that line is dying out, and Salman is probably the last of that line. And so they do need to start thinking about succession in a different way. But when Salman came in, Abdullah had already named the crown prince, who was Prince Mukran, who was the youngest son of King Abdulaziz in his 60s. Well, Salman came in and fired him and named Mohammed bin Nayef, who is from another clan, if you will, in the royal family, as the crown prince. And he's, by the way, very well respected, but it was a significant power grab in a way, a significant decision by Salman that was, in a way, very un-Saudi. Hmm. They operate more smoothly in most cases and without much drama. Hmm. And so this came in as kind of a surprise.
My guest today is Ambassador Robert W. Jordan, a former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week, author of Desert Diplomat Inside of Saudi Arabia Following 9/11, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Let's talk about some of the issues that are confronting Saudi Arabia today. One is tremendous unrest throughout the greater Middle East and the role of Saudi Arabia in those affairs. You've seen them intervene in Yemen militarily. intervening a little bit in Bahrain, playing certainly a role in Syria and everywhere else in the Middle East. What's the bigger game at play for Saudi Arabia, especially these military interventions, which we really have not seen that much of Saudi Arabia except in the two big wars, or the main first war in Iraq?
I think the Saudi worldview has evolved over the last couple of decades into a Sunni versus Shia global confrontation. And they see the evil hand of Iran behind almost every bad thing that they think is happening in the Middle East, from internal dissension in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia to massive protests in Bahrain several years ago, and now, of course, to what's going on in Yemen with the Houthis, who are a Shiite sect. In Syria, the Alawites are also a Shiite sect, and they clearly see Iran supporting Syria, supporting Hezbollah, supporting Hamas, and feeling very threatened with what they would call a Shiite crescent surrounding the Sunni Arab countries of the Gulf. And so I think they're starting to take more responsibility for their own neighborhood. They perceive the U.S. as backing off from the Middle East, as being perhaps unreliable. We pound our chest a good bit and then don't follow through in their eyes. And so I think they have felt that they now need to take a little more initiative, rely a little bit less on us to outsource their security needs to us. And this is the beginning, I think, of a more assertive Saudi Arabia. They've also seen Egypt go down. Hosni Mubarak, who was a stalwart, staunch policeman in the Middle East, if you will, and the Saudis are the next group standing that is capable of projecting force and capable of playing a big role in the Middle East.
As you well know, there's been a body of political thought that says really when you look at this region of the world, the United States can do a lot, a little, somewhat, but really when it comes down to the lasting peace, it's going to be the actors in the region that are going to basically have to take the reins of that region. Is that a good thing or a bad thing that Saudi Arabia is starting to assert this role?
I think it's a good thing they're starting to assert the role. One of the problems, though, that you see in the Middle East is a mentality on either side of winner take all. There's no respect for minority rights. There's no sense of pluralism. And so we saw in Egypt when Mubarak went down, the Muslim Brotherhood came in. They won an election, but they didn't respect the result of the election, which was almost a 50-50 election. They then couldn't govern. The generals then came in and are now governing, and they still have their own opposition and dissidents within Egypt as well. We've seen this time and time again. In Yemen, for example, we saw a new president, Hadi, come in, who wasn't particularly good at governance, and we had a minority population there, the Houthis, who simply wanted their rights addressed. They weren't addressed for decades, and so they started rebellions, military operations, and finally had, I think, unexpected success in taking over Sana'a. And so you're seeing this happen throughout the Middle East, and the Saudis, I think, are in the midst of trying to figure out how do we take charge of our neighborhood and yet not completely obliterate the opposition that wants its own rights recognized. And they have created a narrative now in which any opposition is essentially terrorists incited by Iran. And until they can get over that, I think we're going to see a period of real instability.
And you've said that this military muscle they're starting to show has been with no real strategy or political aim in mind. It's just showing muscle.
They have yet to explain, at least to us or the public, what their political objective is. And of course, military action is only in the service of a political objective. And if the objective is to wipe out the Houthis, I think it's going to be very difficult to ever accomplish. Perhaps to teach them a lesson is possible, and there is talk now that the Houthis have agreed to peace talks, and so maybe the battlefield experience has led to this. But it's a very opaque situation in terms of what their real objective is.
Let's change subject, if we will, to a subject that's near and dear to both Dallas and Tulsa, our two respective homes, and that is the fairly widespread belief around the oil patch that the reason for the low oil prices is Saudi Arabia has opened the spigots. And the reasons go from the plausible to somewhat implausible to political strategy, from just trying to regain market share of the world oil market to working against Russia in the sort of the great game of the Middle East, if you will. What do you think is behind Saudi Arabia opening their oil reserves and increasing the amount of oil out there on the market?
I think their initial and primary objective has been to maintain market share. To oversimplify it, if I'm McDonald's and I decide I want to raise the price of hamburgers by cutting back on my production, what's going to happen to my customers? They're going to go to Burger King. And I think the Saudis have almost that mentality. And this, they've actually seen this happen in the past. They have curtailed production and seen a lot of the customers go to Russia and other producers who are not cutting back on production. For the Saudis to cut back, let's say, 2 million barrels a day, they're producing 11 now. Let's say they cut back to 9. The likelihood of that having any real impact on the international price of oil is small. And so they would have to be leading an OPEC decision in which all of these producers cut back. And these producers aren't as disciplined as they used to be.
The United States is certainly not going to be a part of that.
The United States is not part of OPEC. Russia is not part of OPEC. And so you're going to see the non-OPEC producers continue to try to take market share from the Saudis if they cut back. And so it's really supply and demand and economics 101 that I think is driving a lot of it. Now, it is having the not unhappy effect for the Saudis of really sticking it to Iran and their ability to make any money off of their limited oil production right now.
And if that those sanctions go off, they'll be ramping up their production.
Ramping up dramatically, and they don't want them to be very profitable when that happens. They also are very happy to have the Russians suffering from a glut of oil, since the Russians have contributed to some of this glut. And I think they're happy to make it difficult for the higher cost shale oil producers in the United States to be successful. One of the things that I think the average listener hasn't been told very much is that we have increased the oil supply in the world over the last 5 years by about 9 million barrels a day. Of that, about 4 million is U.S. production increases.
Right.
And so that we are really the ones who have been responsible for a lot of this low oil price by the increase of supply. And the Saudis would like at least to kneecap the high-cost producers. But one of the miscalculations I think the Saudis made was the resiliency and ingenuity of the American oil industry, because the Americans have been able to lower their costs. They can complete a well now, and maybe half the time it used to take them to complete a well. And that dramatically lowers the cost of even some of the shale production. So the ones in the U.S. who are really being hurt are the ones who are paying higher interest rates with high-cost financing, and they don't have the deep pockets to withstand a real decline. There are plenty of shale producers in the U.S. who can make plenty of money off of $50 oil. But the ones who are coming in and thinking they could invest at $80 or $90 oil,
they're the ones that are hurting.
Ones who are hurting. And so the Saudis simply have miscalculated how much of that could be cut off. And the other problem the Saudis have is if they try to take the lead in cutting production and no one else does, they lose international prestige. They look like they can't control OPEC. They look like they can't control the price of oil. And that Wizard of Oz mentality, in a way, might really come back to damage them in terms of reputation.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Ambassador Jordan, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Robert W. Jordan is a former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, serving from 2001 to 2003. He was the guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week and is the author of a new memoir, Desert Diplomat, Inside Saudi Arabia Following 9/11. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.